like a person mentions that 2 + 2 = 4 was, I mean, applicable at the time of Adam.
And but nowadays, it doesn't work today.
It doesn't work today because we have all these technologies. No, it's not the case for, scholarly statement. When it comes to, for example, medicine, we know that we have so many discoveries today, but no one comes to mention that the discoveries of people in the 5th century, all of them are worthless because they were related to a couple of centuries ago. When it comes to astrology and other sciences, when it comes to mathematics. So our point is that we should not think that if something, a statement, a premise, is related to some centuries ago, it doesn't work anymore because of this gap of time. No. So Islam is mainly about La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. So we prove that this world requires a creator, and that is God, and He is only one. And the other attributes which are mentioned, and they are proved by our intellect. So this is an intellectual argument. Which
it's
works
not about what a person tastes or likes or dislikes.
Exactly.
It is something like, it is being said that Islam is, or religion in itself, is the most certain, even in comparison to mathematics. The most certain knowledge and less a branch of knowledge or sciences is the knowledge of theology. Even in comparison to mathematics, it is being said that the knowledge or the science of theology is even more certain and accurate. So, because it talks about the whatever is certain, the certainties of people are going to be put in front of him to see if La ilaha illallah is a true word or not. Mm-hmm. So if it worked in the past, so it can work even today. Thank you very much for the explanation,
so
Sheikh.
Islam says that you have no right to follow the religion of Islam blindly. Rather, you need to apply your reason to come to this conclusion that there is only one God. And the same is true about the fundamental beliefs as well. When it comes to ethics, all the moral instructions of Islam are applicable today. You cannot find even one moral instruction by Islam and then claim that, no, it was related to 14 centuries ago, and today with all these technologies, we do not need them anymore. The same is true about the religious laws and so on and so forth. So, to put it in a nutshell, the first point is that, unfortunately, many people who argue against Islam, they neglect or they do not refer to the same arguments when it comes to other great people in the history of human beings. I mentioned a couple of examples like Aristotle and great poets, for example, and Cyrus or Confucius, Buddha, and so on and so forth. So it seems that, it's not a problem with the teachings of Islam. Their main problem is with the religion and with the personality of our Prophet, peace be upon him. And second of all, the other point was that the teachings of Islam, we need to pay attention to the teachings of Islam. Yes, one may argue that the teachings of a specific school were related to that time and place.
Yeah.
But when we examine the teachings of Islam in terms of theology, morality, and religious laws, we can argue that nothing has been changed. 2 + 2 = 4. There is no God, but Allah is exactly like that, or as you mentioned, even that can be considered as more certain than that as well.
Okay, thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and answers to the question and about the functionality of the religion of Islam in our today's era and life. Inshallah, we shall get back to you, dear brothers and sisters, with another doubt or misconception to be answered. And from among your questions, even. And you are invited to send your questions to our show with this email address, englishradio@irib.ir. All of your questions are warmly welcomed. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban.
إن في الجنة نهرا لمن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روبا شابت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemen's capital Sana'a has hosted an exhibition on those who have lost their lives in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis have visited the exhibition, which was held in the occasion of Yemen's Martyrs Week. The organizers of the exhibition highlighted the importance of unity among resistance groups in the region in the face of US-backed aggressions.
The sacrifices made by these martyrs are great, and they came to end the injustice of the Yemeni people. And they are also a source of inspiration for various people to stand in the face of the invaders. And all the resistance groups should unite against the aggressors. Our martyrs stood against the invaders led by the United States and Israel and their Saudi and Emirati tools who seek to plunder Yemeni's wealth. The martyrs are from all segments of society, and this is evidence of the sincerity of the cause that they died to defend. And Yemenis learned from this occasion the values of great sacrifice.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen, which started in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children. The war has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
People here say they will never forget the sacrifices made by those who stood up and defended their country against the Saudi aggression till their last breath. They say Riyadh's war crimes will not go unpunished and Saudi Arabia will be brought to justice for its atrocities. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, partly due to Western sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Authorities say that sources needed to produce oxygen for coronavirus patients have run out, so as the supplies of many essential drugs. Hospital workers are struggling with acute shortages, while they have not been paid for months.
US sanctions against the Islamic Emirate now mean sanctioning the Afghan people. When the health sector doesn't receive enough support, and Afghanistan's assets are not freed, people's daily life becomes difficult and health services would collapse. My demand as an Afghan doctor from world countries, especially those who have blocked our assets, is that they should have a look at the economic and medical situation of the people of Afghanistan and free the money. If the US has a problem with the Taliban, it must be solved through talks rather than by pressuring our patients.
With the winter coming, hospitals will receive more patients. But nowadays, nothing is free for them, and they hardly can afford to buy food and medicines.
Before the Taliban takeover, we used to receive food and medicines, but since the Taliban have taken power, there is no food, neither for patients nor for doctors. There are a few medicines available here, but doctors say most of them have already run out.
As I witnessed, first of all, most of the doctors were absent. It is said that they are disappointed because they have been unpaid for months. Second, the hospital rooms are very cold. In addition, there is a shortage of food and medicines. Patients share their food with hospital staff. It is world countries' duties to send humanitarian assistance to the Afghan health centers.
After the Taliban took over, the US froze some $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. The White House last week dismissed an immediate release of the money. The freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. has dragged Afghanistan into hunger and the health crisis. Afghans say they have been harmed by sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the U.S. and some Western states have played a big role. The U.S. itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on U.S. policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by 2 decades of the US-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
On Thursday, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition. So it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level.
The Islamic Republic regards itself as a major victim of rights violation, many of which, it says, were committed by the proponents of the recent anti-Iran resolution. So Tehran says those countries are in no position to lecture others on human rights. and such resolutions will only kill the chance for constructive dialogues. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
It is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative programme, Queen's Speech as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks as to the how tone deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter, London.
France has withdrawn from northern Mali and the historic city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or even French Parliament. Mali initially became destabilized in 2011 following France's illegal arms drops to anti-Gaddafi militants in Libya. The arms were then used by Tuareg separatists who have demanded more rights ever since colonial France first dictated Mali's peculiar bow-tie-shaped borders. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been two military coups in little over a year, while increasing demonstrations against France's presence could no longer be ignored or sufficiently repressed.
It's very difficult for France to justify its presence, even more so because the people of Mali, who are neither Tuareg nor Islamists, have been protesting France's presence in the country. So what the Malians want is not really very clear, except the fact that they want the French gone.
The war has been so ineffectual that Malians openly accuse France of arming the rebels, while the conflict is often dubbed France's Afghanistan. Paris has blamed Russian disinformation for turning Malian public opinion against France, but polls in the capital, Bamako, have shown that 80% of respondents believe that France is only in Mali to defend French interests.
France's failed war in Mali has been even more degrading to its image at home and abroad than their failed involvement in Afghanistan. The war has been routinely cited by terrorists as justification for attacks in France.
France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of their former colonies gained nominal independence. Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of natural resources.
It's believed that Mali has some very important resources that have yet to be tapped, like neighboring Niger, which is rich in uranium. And once again, let's not forget, France gets nearly 80% of its energy from nuclear power. So uranium is an important asset for the French. But it would be difficult for France to say, yeah, we're going to stay in Mali because there's this potential uranium deposit, plus the gold, plus this, plus that, etc.
Analysts say that it's premature to call it the end of the war, but that France is entering into a new phase of the war. France will retain a 3,000-strong army to roam the Sahel region. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki says the Islamic movement aims to raise awareness about Islam. He says malevolent intent is behind the allegations that the IMN is an association. He asked the media to stop referring to his supporters as if they are members of an organization, explaining that they are just activists.
We don't have membership card, right? You don't register to become part of Islam. Once you are active, you are just active. That's all. It's open for all Muslims, not only Muslims. It is open even to non-Muslims. You may know that, maybe you don't know. There is Christian forum of the Islamic movement. What happened?
Sheikh Zazaki said many Nigerians have marked the 6th anniversary of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds of his supporters were murdered in cold blood by security forces. He said the extent of the heinous crimes committed during the massacre is beyond comprehension, as the attack was completely unprovoked.
We are running a kind of hospital in that Husseinia, the center. They murdered all the patients and all the nurses and all the doctors. Over 1,000 people were murdered in 3 days. And they all carried all their bodies and dumped them in different mass graves. Even a dead person has a right to be buried according to his religious belief.
Nigerians from diverse cultural backgrounds convened to attend the public lecture to mark the 6th anniversary of the massacre. The hearing for a suit challenging the confiscation of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife's passports will be held on January 18th. Meanwhile, the Islamic cleric said he will have to stay with a dangerous bullet shrapnel in his body. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the 7th round of talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna, Iran says its new proposals and amendments will be included in a text that all sides have agreed will form the basis of future negotiations. Iranian lead negotiator Ali Boghedikhani said the sides had come up with two new drafts, one on the removal of U.S. sanctions and another on Iran's nuclear commitments, that were different from the text that had been discussed in the previous round of talks that ended in June. Boghedi said Iran had resisted attempts by the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France and Germany, to go back to the June text.
In the past week, up until Thursday, we faced an illogical position from the Europeans whereby they wanted to omit the viewpoints of the Iranian side as a basis for talks. Ultimately, with the resistance of the Iranian side and with the reasoning and logic of the Iranian side, they accepted that the Islamic Republic's viewpoints be included in the nuclear draft and form the basis of negotiations.
The EU coordinator said if tough political decisions are not made soon, saving the JCPOA would no longer be possible.
We are in a situation, both in sanctions and nuclear, where difficult political decisions have to be taken. So, again, it is not going to be easy. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be complex. It's going to be politically painful.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the delegates don't have months but rather weeks to come to an agreement. He urged all sides to establish clear priorities and to come back with open and realistic viewpoints about what can be achieved. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Cinema Verite is the only festival in Iran that honors documentary filmmakers. The week-long cinematic event closed with an award ceremony in Tehran and prized the top documentaries of the year. by filmmakers from Iran and the world. There's no limit for the themes of the entries. They can cover the sufferings of four ravaged nations or deal with the socioeconomic impacts of the coronavirus. Among the films that received an award this year was Alireza Memaryani's Broken Bones. The feature documentary narrates a bonesetter's concern about wildlife in Iran's southern Hormuz Island and his continuous effort to raise awareness of the critically endangered local deer that are falling victim to human intervention in their habitat. It's the 15th edition of Cinema Verite. Last year, it was held online due to the coronavirus pandemic, and this year, the films were screened both online and in theaters. 551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to contest. Foreign laureates were not present at the festival due to the pandemic, and their awards were handed to representatives from their country's embassies. Documentaries must glue the audience to their seats with true yet touching stories instead of fiction, and with genuine scenes instead of visual effects. So docs that nab the Cinema Verite Award are definitely worth the top of the list of our must-watch films. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says they have carried out another retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia. He said the Yemen military struck aircraft hangars at the King Khalid Air Base in Nasir region and other sensitive targets in Jizan with five ballistic missiles.
This operation is part of the campaign to put pressure on the Saudi enemy because it only understands the language of force, and the silence of the international community encourages the Saudi regime to shed Yemeni's blood. We are carrying out military operations to make the Saudi regime understand that it must stop its airstrikes that are killing civilians all over the country. And we will continue to target Saudi facilities until the war stops.
Sariya said the attack came in response to the escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia against Yemeni civilians. He vowed larger attacks unless Riyadh stops its ongoing war and siege.
These attacks come in the context of responding to the crimes of the Saudi enemy and the Saudi escalation in targeting civilians with air raids, whether in Sana'a or in other provinces. The Yemeni retaliatory attacks have penetrated the Saudi airspace and paralyzed the Saudi military. It is our right to respond to Saudi Arabia until the war and siege stop.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been intensifying its airstrikes across Yemen and killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to launch further operations deep inside the kingdom.
Yemenis believe that the army has the right to hit back at those killing Yemeni women and the children and violating the sovereignty of their country. They say Riyadh should come to realize that the more attacks it conducts against Yemeni civilians, the more painful retaliatory strikes will be carried out against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
So long as some regimes insist on normalizing and turning a blind eye to the Zionist regime's cataclysmic crimes, the impunity with which the regime has operated since its blood-filled birth through the Nakba in 1948 shall undoubtedly persevere with devastating effect, says Zubair Ali Khan Ryder in an article titled Naftali Bennett in UAE, Normalizing Genocide. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. This past Sunday, December 12th, in the latest in a series of proliferating normalization and relationship building activities, the UAE welcomed the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett into the country. In a profound twist of fate, the very same day, the Zionist regime forces shot and killed Jamil al-Khayal, a 31-year-old Palestinian man in Nablus. Just 2 days earlier, Palestinian Jamil Abu Ayash sustained repeated gunshot injuries to the head and was killed by the Zionist regime forces in Beita. Abu Ayash is the 9th Palestinian to have been murdered in the village since May. Indeed, during a cabinet meeting on release of Palestinian prisoners, Bennett himself admitted to conducting and endorsing such killings, stating, "I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there is no problem with that," unquote. These tragic events and their telling synchrony with the UAE's deus welcoming of their perpetrator serves as an effective microcosm of the catastrophic consanguinity between international complicity and persistent government criminality. The UAE provides the Zionist regime with over $6.8 billion in what they call security and surveillance equipment every year. Additionally, the UAE is rapidly intensifying ethical, moral, and legal degradations, have seen the nation announce a plan to strengthen its economic ties with the apartheid regime of Israel to over $1 trillion within the next decade. Such international backing constitutes the backbone of the settler colonial regime, enabling, facilitating, and legalizing its crimes. Since its first inception in the theoretical and philosophical thought, the primary proponents of Zionism and the establishment of a Jewish national regime in Palestine have been categorical in stressing international backing as a fundamental prerequisite for the achievement of Zionism's imperial ambitions. Considered the founding father of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl's vehement efforts to attain British support by embedding Zionism within all realms of British governance and society as an annexation of its prevalent pre-existing imperial ideologies evidence the aforementioned point. So too do the writings of Ziv Jabotinsky, the founder of revisionist Zionism, who stated in his publication, The Iron Wall, that the idea of the Jewish national home in Palestine was solely attainable through brute force and indiscriminate Jewish domination over the native populations. And it was only this inescapable domination by a colossal and impenetrable force, or the Iron Wall, as he coined it, taking the form of an immovable Jewish military force backed by a force that is not dependent on the local population, that would quell the natives' hopes, rendering them powerless to break the Iron Wall down. It is without doubt this Iron Wall of imperial despotism, beginning with the alliance of British Empire and solidifying itself in the notorious Balfour Declaration of 1917, which continues to strengthen and fortify itself to this day through the colossal military, economic, and diplomatic partnerships established between the fake regime of Israel and the UAE among a heinous consortium of other deeply complicit nations. Interestingly, the construction of this political and ideological Iron Wall, stated by Jabotinsky in 1923, was not only realized in its philosophical essence, but also implemented physically through a recently completed colossal 65-kilometer barrier surrounding the horrifically besieged Gaza, which the Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz himself termed an Iron Wall. course, in both physical design and morally bankrupted purpose, this iron wall draws immediate parallels to its architectural predecessor. The Zionist regime's infamous separation wall constructed in 2002, a structure which has been deemed brazenly illegal and condemned by both the International Court of Justice and the United Nations General Assembly. Fronted as a necessary security measure to protect the Zionist regime from the millions of native Palestinian children, women, and men, it so peremptorily deems terrorist the criminality of UAE's annual $6.8 million security and surveillance provisions is glaringly present in the cases of both the former and the latter. It is indeed the recognition of this direct causal relationship between international complicity and the ever-widening sphere of the Zionist regime's criminal activities that has formed the basis upon which popular movements such as BDS have established their strategy of resistance, a brutal occupation, apartheid, and genocide which has endured for over 73 years simply could not exist, let alone thrive, without international support and complicity. The latter is the primary enabler and facilitator of the first. It is of paramount importance that the international community and the various governmental and non-governmental bodies who claim to champion human rights and equality accept their legal, ethical, and humanitarian obligation to fight for justice in Palestine and as such abstain from and unequivocally condemn the establishment, formation, and propagation of both military and diplomatic ties with the apartheid fake regime of Israel. So long as some regimes insist on normalizing and turning a blind eye to the Zionist regime's cataclysmic crimes, the impunity with which the regime has operated since its blood-filled birth through the Nakba in 1948 shall undoubtedly persevere with devastating effect.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Youth Station. I'm your host, Hassanain, and we have Sayyid Jafar. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hassanain.
Brother Sayyid Jafar, yesterday I went to a program and where there was one of this reciter. He recited really good poetry about mother.
Okay.
And you know, I'm like, we being far away from our family and parents, I really miss my family, man. You know, I realize sometimes, you know,
we take our parents' worth for granted, don't we?
Sometimes, yeah, it does happen. So, you know, we don't really value them
as much
as they're supposed to be valued.
Yeah.
So, sometimes I feel like we love our parents, but we don't obey them. And sometimes, you know, I've seen many children that they don't even respect their parents once they get old. Okay, so now you see that we got here with three things, right? So
obeying parents, respecting parents, and loving parents.
Exactly.
The difference,
yeah,
between these. Okay. In one sense, you can say they're all the same. Because if you obey your parents, in a sense, you're respecting their authority, and you're loving them.
It's a chain, right? You know, one leads to the other.
Exactly. But that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
The other way is if you split each one apart. Look. You're in this world because of them, right?
Uh-huh.
The basis of your existence is because of them. Mm-hmm. They weren't there. Boom. You're not here either. Right. So obeying them, right, to an extent.
Right.
To an extent, obeying them is mandatory on us. Right. Mm-hmm. They're older. They're wiser. They've seen this.
Right.
It's not there, in a sense, all my listeners from the South. Mm-hmm. Right. It's not our first rodeo.
Right.
Right. They're doing this for another time. They've already lived through this.
Right.
We're new to this. Mm-hmm. Right. So obeying them is, look, they're going to tell you the mistakes they made so you don't go through those same issues.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make those same mistakes. Mm-hmm. Right. That's obeying them. Yeah. But in some cases, right, where the prophet says you must obey your parents, right, after me, after mm-hmm. God mm-hmm. and me.
Yeah.
It's your parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He's made stages here, right? So it's God, then me, then the parents.
Salam, then parents, yeah.
Exactly. So, look, in some cases, parents, now I'm not going to say they're ma'asum, they're infallible.
Mm-hmm.
They can make mistakes. But look, it's our job to obey them to, again, to an extent where we're within the parameters of Islam.
Yeah.
Right? Now, if they want us to do something that's outside of Islam, according to our narrations, it's allowed to not listen to. Like, we're allowed to go against what they're saying. Because over here, remember.
No. Only when it's against Islam, right?
When it's against Islam.
Our parents suggest us something, but we think that's not good for us.
Uh-huh.
And we know.
Ah, okay. So, right here. This is when that second stage comes in. Respect, right? Mm-hmm. Look, the way the lifestyle and the lifetime of a human being is.
Right.
Look. You're very weak in the beginning.
Right.
You hit your prime, and then you get really weak towards the end as well. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Say, 65, 70 years and onward, you're weak.
Yeah.
Not that you don't know how to do it. It's that you don't have the capability to do it anymore.
Right.
And say, the first 5-7 years,
mm-hmm.
you have the capability here. You have all the potential in the world, but you don't know how to do it. Right?
Right.
It's that middle section where this respect really comes in handy. Right, this is where you can really fit it in,
mm-hmm.
right? It goes, it's in your prime, and it goes to the end of your life,
mm-hmm.
right? In the beginning, you're obeying your parents because you don't know any better, right? Mm-hmm. After a stage, there has to be an understanding between the parents and their
right.
children, whether it's one child or many.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make a difference. I'm going to listen to what you're saying, but look, this is my opinion in the matter as well,
mm-hmm.
right? And you reach a middle ground.
Wait, you discuss about you sit and sort out things with your parents, right?
Yeah.
Okay, when you reach to the result, then you follow that.
Yeah. So in a sense.
So are you trying to say that, you know, first comes obeying, then comes the respect? Oh, dear listeners, let's take a short break over here and we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
If you keep these three things in mind,
yeah.
loving, obeying, and respecting.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about the correct order? What do you think is the correct order? I'm not talking about, okay, when you're young and you start growing, so
uh-huh.
what comes first? Like in general, what should be first? Like that's my question.
In my opinion, there is no first though. Right? What these three are, they're stacked upon each other. Right? All three of them are going with you.
Okay, what about people having one or two and not the others, not the rest?
Uh-huh. So, okay, so for example, which one do they not have?
You know, many people, like from among ourselves, many of us out there, we just love our parents, but we don't obey them.
Okay.
Like, you know,
in a sense, if you don't
like,
obey them,
we're doing the same thing with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. We claim to love Ahlul Bayt, but are we following
their
teachings,
yeah.
their guidelines?
That's
There's
true.
A difference, like
uh-huh.
loving and following. These are two different
That's
things.
That's true. But realize loving is the full form of following.
Yeah.
You follow to such an extent, now you won't be diverted from that path because you love them.
The person is claiming to love someone.
Okay.
And he's not following their guidelines.
So
you cannot say that he's not the lover?
In a sense, could you say he is?
He's not a lover in its true form. But he is claiming to be a lover, right?
In this sense, then you have to really translate what you mean by love.
I guess I don't know. I'm
like,
not
what
sure.
You really mean here, right? It's we're not talking about pure.
Like, let
love
me give
here,
an example.
Then. We're talking about sediments of love. You know, oh, look, when it's in my favor, you know, I'll love them.
Okay, let
is
me
that what
an,
you're trying to say?
Let me give an example. Like, I've heard this riwayat. You know, someone goes to an imam and says that, you know, that this XYZ, this guy is claiming to be your Shia, and he's quitting all this mess. And he's claiming to love Imam and follow Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. What did Imam reply? Imam said, he might be my lover, but he is not my follower. So there's a difference between being a follower and lover.
That's
like
true.
We Shia, we have follower in our names. Like Shiana Ali. Mm-hmm. What does Shiana Ali mean?
The followers of Ali.
But are we really the followers? Like, we need
okay,
to reflect
so
upon ourselves, right?
I think you've helped me understand what you mean by love through your example here. So when you're saying, look, I love them, but that doesn't really mean I'm following them the way I should be following them.
Love in its true form and complete form, it means that, you know, your love should lead you towards you obeying them and following them.
Yeah.
That's what I mean to say.
That's love in its true essence, right?
Mm-hmm.
It encompasses both obedience and respect. But in your example here, you're saying that they love them, but then they don't necessarily obey them.
Yeah, many people like money from among us, right?
Yeah. Okay. So in a sense, you could say that, okay, this love is misplaced then. Where what they think they love isn't what is truly there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is a divider here.
Mm-hmm.
When they think they're really in love,
mm-hmm.
they're not truly in love. They're
you know,
in love
you know,
with the idea,
you
though.
If you talk about apparently what comes first, as you said, that, you know, obeying comes first because when we are young, we don't know anything, so we just follow our parents.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, you know, before obeying, you know, if you talk in that manner, when we are young and it's our growing age, I guess love comes first.
Well, because both of them come hand in hand, right? Because, look, as a child, you won't be able to do
anything.
No, because
I feel love is natural, right? You know, a small baby, he's attached to his parents. He's attached to his mother.
Exactly.
He's attached to his father. That's
natural. But now that love equates into the child obeying the parents as well.
But love is coming first, right? Apparently.
Okay, in that sense, yeah. Love is coming first.
Okay, love is coming first. Then, as you said, you know, our parents know better than us. That leads us in following them.
Yeah.
But then we see, like, respecting them. What I feel that, you know, when the child grows and he starts to believe in himself that he knows better than his parents, and he feels that I can do whatever I want, here comes a stage where he starts disrespecting his parents.
It's well, typically
in fact,
those rebel teenage years.
The child, he's requesting, he's asking his mother to let him go to with his friends to some mountains.
Yeah.
But you know, she's a mother, right? But she's not letting him go out of care. Like, she's worried about her.
Yeah.
You know, she's thinking about the consequences that can take place.
Exactly.
You know, the...
In a sense, they're looking at
the
whole
dangers.
Picture here.
Yeah, she's looking at the whole picture. Like,
yeah.
You know, the dangers that might come, that might take place. So that's the reason. Oh, here, he's stubborn that I want to go with my parents. Here comes disrespecting.
Could you say that it's something that just... that you go through, it's a phase you go through, disrespecting? Or is there more of a reason behind this?
I mentioned the reason.
No, yeah, so you gave
the reason
of they wanted to go out and hang out with their friends. No, but...
That's an example. The reason is when he starts believing in himself that he knows better than his parents.
That's where disrespect comes in.
Yeah.
Okay, so then what's respect then?
We agree that our parents know better than us. They guide us and they help us, you know, get stronger. They take us to the right path. They always think good for us, or here you're obeying your parents. When you're accepting all these things, when you're agreeing with this criteria, you respect them, right?
But then what is respect on its own, right? You're making the prerequisite to respect. Am I wrong to say that respect is a mutual understanding between parent and child? You thinking about yourself and not taking into consideration what your parents are saying. Respect should be the opposite, right?
Mm-hmm.
That where you don't have a say for yourself. But what I'm saying is that's also wrong. Respect is the correlation of trust between parent and child.
Mm-hmm.
To a level where they understand each other better.
Right.
Right? Where they can come to a conclusion together. Where it in a sense, it works for both parties.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's respect. Right? Look,
yeah.
I might not listen to you this time, but don't think what you say means nothing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where you really, it's not, you're not just taking what they say with a grain of salt.
I respect your words.
You're taking it in completely.
Yeah.
But maybe our thoughts at this moment regarding this topic might be different. But that doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, cuss you out and, like, not listen to you whatsoever. No.
Exactly.
There's an understanding there.
Our ideas might not align
at this moment.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean it's never going to align. There will be a moment where it aligns.
Okay, when you ask me, like, what's respect, I feel like, you know, respect you can understand better when you understand disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I tell you that there's a difference between disrespect and disagreeing with someone.
Uh-huh.
Having disagreements. It's a different thing, right?
Yeah.
You like coffee, I like tea. Suppose, for example.
Okay.
Differences between us. You like coffee, I like tea. But we are not disrespecting each other,
no.
Right?
So, respect here is understanding what the other person's comfortable with.
Exactly.
And having them understand what you're comfortable with.
Exactly.
And say, look, if we
not
have the
making
same
someone feel uncomfortable.
Exactly. Don't destroy someone's beliefs because you don't believe in them. Understand that, look, maybe he has different beliefs from me, but that doesn't mean we can't be in the same place and talk about the same thing.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, dear audience, for staying with us. Lots and lots of love for our parents from the studio of IRIB English Radio. With that being said, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, I will when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.